So the title of the talk is The Long-Enduring Mind. But the way my teacher in Burma recently put it is, meditation is more like a marathon than a 100-yard dash. I think when we first come to practice, most of us come looking for some kind of experience. We've heard about meditation, or we have a lot of stress in our life or something, and we want to get some relief, or we want to understand meditation, or we've heard good things about it, but we don't really know what it is. And I think we come with the expectation that we're going to get something. And now, having practiced for, 3 decades, and some of you I know have been practicing for close to that, we have to reflect a little bit and say, well, what is it that we really get from all of this immersion in the Dharma or instruction or retreats or mindfulness, however it is? And I think that one of the lessons that we all come to learn again and again in practice is that transforming the mind from its conditioned, individual, self-centric, fearful personality to a liberated, free, open, understanding energy is that it's a never-ending process. And I know that maybe beginners don't like to hear that because we want something. And that's good motivation initially. But somewhere along the line, we have to kind of let go of trying to get something from our practice, but realize instead that rather than we doing practice, practice does us. And what I mean by that is we make a lot of effort, and we try to apply ourselves, and we listen to instructions, and we get inspired, and we do what we're told, and we try to be mindful. And but what actually happens is quite beyond our control. Whether the mind actually is mindful, whether we do understand, it's not for us to choose. But gradually, over the course of time and years of practice, I think we do begin to understand. And I think to clarify what the path of practice is really important. I know when I first started practice, it was just kind of a spin-off from doing drugs. You know, it's like, well, drugs are good, maybe this has got something to offer. And I think I was really looking for some kind of exotic, different, phantasmagorical type experience. And believe me, there are lots of phantasmagorical experience in meditation practice. You'd like it louder. I don't know how to turn it louder. There are lots of phantasmagorical experiences to be discovered on the path of awakening, on the path of liberation, or on the meditative path. But experiences are meaningless if experiences have no value other than how we understand them. And the path of mindfulness and insight, or vipassana, as we are mostly practicing in this tradition, is the path of understanding. It's not the path of acquiring experiences, it's the path of understanding. And I think the direction of that understanding is towards more wisdom, more compassion, and recognizing our place in the larger world rather than finding ourselves in our small, personal little world. When I say understanding is the goal of practice, the corollary of that is that happiness and peace are just the results. And while many of us look for and try to be happy, and the things we do in our life are really to try to be happy. Most of what we do has happiness as it's in that direction. We don't do things wanting to be unhappy. We do things wanting to be happy. But we are notably unsuccessful much of the time. And I think we need to learn from that we don't always know what's best for us. And when we pay attention to what it is that causes us to be unhappy or causes us to suffer, then we're really beginning the path of understanding. Because the meditative path, or the path of mindfulness, or the path of awakening, is to discover what is in the way of you being happy, you being peaceful. Imagine you go to a new place, some place you've never been before, whether it's a foreign country or a different section of town, and you just don't know who or what they do there. It would be very difficult to feel at ease, wouldn't it? But if you were told beforehand, well, this is where you're going, and this is what the people do, and this is what you can expect, and this is what it's like there, then you would feel a little bit more at ease. But only after you'd gone there and experienced it for yourself would you truly deal with your own fears and anxieties and insecurities and unknowings, and then be at ease. Our mind is like that. Mostly, we know what we think, but we do not know the mind. The mind is vast. The depth of the mind is just tremendously vast. And mostly, we live our life on the surface of what is immediately apparent. And what is immediately apparent is our conditioning, our personality. What we like, what we don't like, what we want, what we're afraid of, our ambitions, our fears, our pride, our sorrows, joys. That's what we're familiar with. And yet, this is just the bare surface of the mind. And what is below that mind, or what is the source of all of that, is available. It's available. And the way we access what is available in the mind or to the mind is from just observing. Just observing. Just paying attention. Not trying to get anything special. Not trying to make something happen, but not avoiding anything either. But just observing the very ordinary, mundane, familiar experiences of our life. I didn't believe it. You know, I started meditation looking for something phantasmagorical. And over again, all the teachers and all the practices keep pointing back to what is your immediate experience right now. That's where it all takes place. That's where it all happens. That's where our personality is revealed, and that's where the depth of the mind is revealed. I was practicing. I went to Burma again in January to practice with a teacher that I've been practicing with for a couple of years now. His name's Utejaniya. And he's the successor to a monk that I practiced with many years ago, back in the early 90s in Burma. And I'd heard that his teacher
the Shuiyumin Saira. This is called the Gold Cave Hermitage Saira. I'd heard that he was widely considered to be, possibly to be, a fully enlightened being. He just passed away a couple of years ago. And that he had psychic powers, and many, many people had told stories about him where they felt sure that he was able to read their minds. Because he would talk about things in their life before they opened their mouth. He would acknowledge things that they had brought for him, what they wanted to talk about. And there's just many instances. So I asked my teacher, I said, I've heard that the Shuiyumin Saira is reputed or reported to have psychic powers. What do you think? Is that what you who have, having practiced with him for many years and knew him quite intimately, what do you think? Did he have psychic powers? Now, let me just do a little survey. Anybody here know, be able to read others' minds? Well, it's not, you know, but, okay. So I asked him if he thought that his teacher was able to read minds or know other people's thoughts. And he said, I wouldn't attribute such lowly accomplishments to this teacher. And then he went on to talk about how wise his teacher was, the Shuiyumin, and how much understanding there was in his observation of the way things are. So that when he saw someone and their behavior, he would understand about that person. The depth of his understanding included and surpassed what we might consider as some fantastic accomplishment. And so I think it's important for us to begin to fine-tune the direction of our practice towards understanding. How do we understand our experience? It's not what experience are we having, but how do we understand it? What do we know about ourselves from this experience? So we just sat for 40 minutes. And you know, most of you have probably been working today and, you know, a little bit tired and it's Friday night. And what do you know about yourself from that experience? From 40 minutes of just paying attention? Well, did you just calm down and kind of get some relief from that? Did you just find out that you're just agitated and tired? Or what? I mean, because we were paying attention, we do know something about ourselves. What do we understand about that? So I went to Burma again in January to practice with this Utejaniya. And he has a very, different way of offering instructions for developing mindfulness. And you go to this monastery, and it's on the outskirts of Rangoon, and it is the noisiest place on earth. It is so noisy there. There's so much traffic. There's loudspeakers in all the monasteries and nunneries and coffee shops around there. And they're blaring out karaoke, Burmese karaoke, Burmese opera, monks and nuns chanting at all hours of the day and night. The electricity is off for about 20 hours a day in Burma. And so they run generators to, you know, outside my window. And the water all has to be pumped up into tanks so that there's pressure. So there's pumps going, loud, noisy, clanging pumps going all the time. There's dogs barking, chickens cackling, people talking. Who could practice in an environment like that? Well, actually practicing there is not so different than trying to practice in Seattle, I think. You know, there's a lot of distraction, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of sensory input. Your experience of all that sensory input is neither an impediment or to practice, nor is it a benefit to practice. It's how you understand all that that makes a difference. Can you understand all of that stimulation in your life, all of those thoughts in your mind, all of those fears, all those desires? Can you understand them in a way that allows you to be at ease? If you can't, then you need to still practice. If you can, then your practice is maturing. And that's what, it's not about whether you have thoughts in your mind. We're not trying to get rid of our thoughts in practice, but we're trying to understand the nature of thinking. And so that when we get irritated by our partner's behavior, something at work, our neighbors, politicians, we have lots of opportunity to get upset, get irritated, get frustrated, get disappointed. If we do, that's our problem. Because how we're relating to the experiences of life is a reflection of our understanding or lack of it. There's always going to be unpleasant experiences in life. How can we be aware of unpleasantness and not suffer, not be upset, not be frustrated, not be disappointed, not be irritated? These reactions or these reactivity of the mind are called defilements. When the mind is defiled with any unwholesome, unskillful mental state, we will suffer. Whether we suffer loneliness, frustration, disappointment, depression, fear, desire, pride, whatever else you have. This is the work of meditation, to learn to identify suffering and the causes of suffering, to be able to make the adjustments in our understanding so that we can be in that situation, we can be aware of that situation and not caught in that reaction. So, I go to the monastery and I start to practice. And the first thing the teacher says is relax. Relax the body. So let me just give you this instruction. Relax your body. We're all sitting here. Let's relax. Relax the body. Okay? Now relax your mind. What do you do to relax your mind? When I say relax your body, we know what to do, don't we? We go, and we relax. We look for the source of tension and we unclench the hands, we relax the back, we relax the jaw, we stop squinting, and it's like we relax. But the important part of meditation practice is to learn how to relax the mind. What do? Well, that's practice. How to relax the mind. Because we don't know how. I mean, what can you do to relax the mind? Because the mind is not so tangible, is it? It's not so apparent. Where is the mind anyway? This mind that we all have. Meditation is mind work. It's not body work. Whether you sit, whether you stand, whether you sit cross-legged, half-legged, full lotus, half lotus, no lotus, stand on your head, lay down, walk fast, walk slow, doesn't matter. Because you can develop mindfulness in any posture. It's not what the body's doing that is meditation. It's what the mind is doing. That's meditation. So what is your mind doing right now? Well, is it hearing what is being said? Yeah? Okay. That's how you know you have a mind. Is it feeling the body sitting in the chair, maybe comfortable or uncomfortable? It is the mind that feels the body. It is the mind that hears these sounds. It is the mind that makes sense of what is being said. It is the mind that has a reaction to what is being said. And so The work of meditation is to attend to that mind, observe that mind that is knowing all of these experiences. Meditation is not about paying attention to the breath. You can use the breath as an experience to observe, to be attentive to, and to learn something about the mind from. But the breath has no greater significance than that. I had a monk in Thailand teach me to just raise and lower the arm, or the hand, like this. But it's not the raising and lowering of the hand that's so important. It is developing the attention that can know that as it occurs. Okay, what's the difference between knowing the raising and lowering of the hand or knowing the turning of the wheel as you're driving your car? If you can sit and pay attention to your arm lifting and lowering, you can sit and pay attention to the movement of your arms as you drive your car. So really, driving a car is as meditative as sitting quietly with your eyes closed. Because meditation is the work of the mind. It's not the work of the body. And so, this teacher, or my teacher, encourages us to relax and to pay attention. You can sit for as long or as short a time as you want. You can walk normal pace, please. Don't walk slow. And you can sleep as much as you like. You can sit for as much as you like. You can talk if you like. But pay attention. Observe everything that's going on in the mind. Okay, now you've been sitting here for more than an hour now. Feel the sensations in your right hand. Without moving it, just feel the sensations in your right hand. Can you feel that? Can you feel sensations in your right hand? Or can you feel sensations in your butt that's sitting on the chair or the cushion? Feel the sensation? Yeah. Okay. How much energy did that take? Did it take a lot of energy to feel the sensations in your hand? Or to feel the sensations in your butt? Doesn't, does it? It's almost nothing. It's like, how easy can it get? How, you know. That's all it takes to be mindful. Just that much energy. It's no more than that. More energy than that, and you're struggling. You know, you're going, trying to be with the breath, or, you know, trying to keep your attention here. So, all that's extra energy. Tires you out. What's difficult about being mindful or developing the meditative mind is doing it continuously. It's easy in a moment of someone saying, notice this, notice that. Notice the sensations in your right hand, your left foot, your right foot, top of your head, inside your mouth, whatever. Notice the thoughts in your mind. Notice the thoughts in your mind. Yeah. Okay. Not difficult to do. What's difficult to do is to do that continuously. And why is it difficult to do continuously? Because we don't have the habit of doing it. Instead, we have the habit of worry, planning, judging, scheming, strategizing, wanting, not wanting, and that's what we spend our time doing. Meditation is learning to observe all those things without being involved in them. We say, or my teacher says, the mind is not yours, but you are responsible for it. Do you choose the thoughts you have in your mind? Most of us do not. Most of us have all kinds of thoughts we'd just as soon not have. Right? Especially at times when we really wouldn't like to have them. And yet, we're responsible for those thoughts. We can't control the mind. We don't control what the mind knows. But we have to take responsibility for what we do with what the mind knows. Nobody else is going to take that for you. But if we pay attention and we observe closely what the mind knows, then we begin to understand, oh, these thoughts come when XYZ happens. Oh, I feel angry or irritated when this happens. Or I feel depressed when that happens. And we begin to understand our experience. We begin to understand the relationship between cause and effect. Very important to begin to see this. Or we begin to understand that what we experience is really not so personal. How's the temperature in here? Are you feeling warm? Does anybody feel warm? Yeah, some people feel warm. I feel a little warm. Do some of you feel cool? Some of you feel cool. No? Some of you, okay. Do some of you feel uncomfortable? Like, you've been sitting for a while, it's a little bit uncomfortable? Do some of you feel very comfortable? Like, wow, this is just like sitting in the living room watching a video. Not likely. But then, anyway, when you feel comfortable, or when you feel hot, or when you feel cool, what makes you think that it's your feeling? The feeling of when I feel hot and you feel hot, is there any difference? It is really just the way things are, isn't it? If the temperature of the room is 85, each of us will experience feeling hot. That's the nature of feeling hot. Or if the heat goes off or whatever happens, if the windows are open and the wind blows through, we'll all feel cool. Is it personal to you to feel cool? No. This is the nature of coolness. It's the nature of experience that if it's hot, you feel hot. If it's cool, you feel cold. If you sit for a long time, you feel uncomfortable. If you put yourself in a certain situation, you'll feel frustrated. Or you feel miserable, or you feel depressed. It's not personal. It is the way things are. It's a hard lesson to learn, because mostly we've been taught, and our conditioning is to take things personally. This is my body, and this is my mind, and this is my fear, and this is my anxiety, and this is my depression, and this is my ambition, and this is my practice. But an important understanding to begin to plant in your mind is that this is all impersonal. You don't have to take it as dogma. You don't have to force yourself to believe it. But just to begin to let this understanding work in the background of your attention. You know what? Maybe this is just happening due to causes and conditions. What we experience in the body, what we experience in the mind, it's just causes and conditioning. So I went to see this teacher in Burma, and I had an opportunity without the translator one time. He speaks pretty good English, but he often teaches with a translator, through a translator. And I went to see him one time without the translator, and we spoke for an hour and a half or so. And I was talking to him about his teacher, the Shwelu Mensaidor, who, as I mentioned, had a tremendous amount of understanding, of really understanding what it was he was observing, to the point of being very wise. And my teacher said that he would see him wait until someone was ripe to hear the teachings, and then offer them what they needed to hear. He said that he saw his teacher wait for years sometime for someone to be ready to hear what would free them, or what would, the understanding that would allow them to let go of something that they were holding on to. What is it, I began to think, that will keep us practicing, will keep us looking, will keep us hanging in there for all those years until the teacher offers us what we need to hear? What is it that's going to inspire you to practice? Because for many of us, practice is a lot of work. It's a lot of time, a lot of work, a lot of whatever. And sometimes the results aren't immediately obvious. And so we need to have something to keep us going. What is it? What is it that keeps you going? What is it that keeps you looking? It's important to ask the question, for each one of us to ask the question of ourselves, what am I looking for? What am I trying to get? What is the benefit to me of doing this? And begin to understand for ourselves why we do what we do. And as we go along, of course, our answers will change what it is we get, what motivates us, what inspires us. When I first started practicing with this teacher, after a few weeks, I noticed a feeling in my practice that I'd never noticed before. Or at least I should say, I never spoke about before. And that was a feeling of well-being. Mostly in practice we know, oh, energy or tiredness. We know when we're feeling light or confident. We know when we're feeling balanced or imbalanced, anxious. But a feeling of well-being was kind of unexplainable. It wasn't sensations in the body. It wasn't really kind of like thoughts in the mind, because there were still thoughts in the mind. Some of them I enjoyed, some of them I didn't. There were still sensations in the body. Some of them were pleasant, some of them were unpleasant. But behind them, or the knowing of them, was coming through a filter or coming with the understanding of a feeling of well-being. And I mentioned this to my teacher. I said, there's this kind of like pervasive feeling of well-being, even while, you know, sometimes it's difficult in practice. And he said, that's the direction that understanding takes you, to a feeling of well-being. It doesn't change your experience. You still have pleasant and unpleasant, physical and mental. You have emotional dramas. You have things going on. You have thoughts and plans and all kinds of things tormenting you. But even within all that, there can develop, or there can be, a very strong and pervasive feeling of well-being. And that comes from understanding. Having the correct understanding of your experience. We can understand things correctly, or we can understand things wrongly. If you understand things wrongly, you will feel uncomfortable. If you understand things correctly, you're more likely to feel either comfortable or have a feeling of well-being. That's the direction of practice. That's the direction of understanding. So, back in the 90s, when I first met the Shui Yu Minsaido, I was introduced to him, and I went and practiced with him for a while. And I had this impression of him, you know, as being a very sincere and living quite simple, being a very... He was just very alert without straining. He wasn't like struggling to be anything. He was just who he was. And I'd heard that for many years, from the time he was in his 50s to the time he died in his 90s, that he would just go away for 2, 3, 4, 5 months a year and just do his own practice. And I thought, well, that's pretty noble of him to just wander away, leave his monastery and go do that. And when I went to practice with him, he just had a little grove. There was a 2 or 3, maybe only 2 acres a grove of old trees kind of in the suburbs of Rangoon. And it was very quiet and cool. It was still there. And it was very simple life there. So I hadn't been back since 1990, so I wanted to go back there just to see what it was like. And I went back there, and everything was gone except the trees. And in its place was all these cement, two or three story cement buildings, a monastery, a new dining hall, a new dormitories, and it was nothing like I had imagined, or nothing like I remembered. I was totally disillusioned with it. And in speaking with my teacher, I said, when I practiced with the Shui Yu Min, I had the sense, and this is what I knew about him. And I said, I was really impressed that he went away every year and practiced on his own in solitude for 2, 3, 4, 5 months. And he said, oh yeah, he went away every year, but he didn't go alone. He said, all kinds of people went with him. Another disillusionment. It was so shocking to me to find out that what I thought about him was not so. How I remembered the place and the practice, not so. Sometimes we are supported in our practice by things that are not so. Sometimes we have images of ourselves in practice or others in practice. Inspiring. So inspiring. It helps us to endure, to develop this long enduring mind that can put up with our yabbering, nagging personality. And so we do that. And then later we find out it's not so. I have a current inspiration for my practice that I want to tell you about. I was in the monastery practicing. And, you know, for those of you who've been on retreat, you know, it's in silence pretty much. And, you know, you're kind of keeping to yourself and just paying attention to yourself. But somehow you notice everybody else. And you notice everything about them. It just happens that way. Awareness is really amazing. So my attention was called to this nun, this Burmese nun. And I was really struck by her, what appeared to be the simplicity, the sincerity, the continuity of her practice. She just seemed to be very sincere and diligent, without being grim or determined, you know, really tight about it. And she was just, I don't know, every time I saw her, I was really inspired by her. And so I just noticed her. And I was sitting in the dining room with at a table. There was just two people at this table. One, it was an old man. He was about 70 or something. And he was just visiting. He was actually the father of the abbot, one of the abbots. And he was in Rangoon for some medical tests. And while he was there, he was just staying in the monastery doing a little practice. And this nun would bring him every meal a little rolled up piece of paper with some vitamins or some medicine in it. And so she would come to the table and I would see her and she would just hand him the medicine and she would go get her own meal. So one day I got up my courage and I felt a little self-conscious, I think. And I asked her in Burmese if she understood or spoke English. And she said in Burmese, no. Of course, that's all I knew about Burmese. I don't know Burmese. And she didn't know English. I mean, I asked her if she spoke English. She didn't. So that was the end of that conversation. But still, I had this kind of like, I wonder who she is. I wonder what her life's like. I don't know, you know. And I felt really, I felt very kindly towards her. I felt, I don't know if this is the right word, but I felt paternal to her. I felt like I wanted to be a benefactor to her. So I said, all right, well, she doesn't speak English again. I'll wait till the end of my stay, on the last day that I'm here, I'll get the translator and I'll go talk to her. So I was just waiting till, you know, I was practicing and I got close to the end of my period there and she left.
Her time was up at the monastery. She left 4 days before me. I said, oh, God. Well, she didn't show up for one meal. I felt heartbroken. So, oh, my gosh, she must be sick. Next meal, she didn't come. So I went to the office to find out, and she left. So I said, well, I missed my opportunity. So on the last day, I went to the abbot, and I said, by the way, do you know that girl that was offering your father his medicine? Do you know that nun? Do you know who she is, or where she is? Oh, yeah, she's from Upper Burma. And I said, oh, well, Upper Burma. And I guess she's gone. So he said, yeah, but she's in Rangoon now. She's staying in Rangoon for a few days. So he found out where she was staying. So I went to see her. And I went to the nunnery where she was staying, and she wasn't there. She had been there, but she'd gone away for a few days. So I had said to the translator, tell her to stay here when she gets back. So when I had to go to Upper Burma and traveling for a few days. So I went to Upper Burma, and when I came back, I got another translator. I went to the nunnery again to find her, and she was there. So, you know, how do you approach somebody you don't know anything about? You have a feeling about, it's like, I suppose it's like, you know, dating. Something like dating, although, you know, dating a nun. But, so I said to her, I said, well, I saw you practicing at the nunnery, at the monastery, and I was just impressed by, you know, your demeanor. So I said, what do you do? What do you do in your life? What's your life like? Where do you live? What do you do? So she told me that she lived in Upper Burma, and she lived with one other nun, and they were practice nuns. They're not study nuns, and they're not teaching nuns, and they don't live in a big nunnery. They're just two of them. Someone gave them a piece of land, 60 feet by 80 feet, about half the size of this room. That's where they live. So they have a building there, and they just practice from 4 in the morning till somewhere late at night. And they go to the village, and they get some food, and they have a garden. They tend their garden. And they listen to a Dharma talk each day, and they do an hour of puja or devotion. And they sit 4 or 5 hours a day. And they just live very simply to practice. I was so impressed. You really could see that when someone just practices, they do do what they have to do, but they just practice very sincerely. It really is apparent in their behavior. It comes out through them. The wisdom or the understanding or the gentleness, really, I think it is. It's the gentleness of being with your life not in an aggressive way. I was really impressed. So I offered her some support to support her while she's in Rangoon for a while. But I was really impressed with how sincere practice is transformative in a very apparent way. And I think maybe what was most amazing to me is that I could recognize that. So, the end. So it's about 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. Do you have any questions or comments that you'd like to share or ask? Or we could just sit quietly for another 20 minutes. Or we will sit quietly for another 20 minutes. Or if you don't have any questions for me, I have questions for you.
Sure. Or the type of suffering where there is an incredible pain there, and it's like dismissive to say this is an impersonal reaction that I have, like to somebody laying on the street. I mean, you know, in incredible agony or a sort of or you know, those kind of dramatic types of suffering that I feel a lot of the suffering that we discuss in class that makes sense to me that you depersonalize yourself from is probably like 90% of what we experience as suffering, which is self-created. I understand that. But where I get kind of confused is, what about, you know, being propelled or compelled to action by a true example of suffering? And, you know, something between, you know, having a real passion that you are compelled to action and being impersonal. Where is that? There's something in between there that I have trouble wrapping my brain around.
It's a good question because there's suffering all around us. There's suffering all within us too. And so how do we respond, or what moves us to respond? You know, when a child falls down and skins their knee, you know, for example, you don't have to think about picking a child up and rubbing the knee, or just gently touching the knee, or just, you know, giving them some attention. You know, if we could be so kind of uninhibited with the other suffering that we see in the world and just give some attention, it's not that we're going to fix it. I mean, you're not going to fix that child's skinned knee or bumped head or whatever it is. You're not going to make it go away. You're not going to take it away. They still have to deal with the pain of that, the discomfort of it, the whatever comes. But your expression of care for them can relieve them of the aloneness of their suffering. That's where the real suffering of suffering is in, I am alone with this. That, you know, what you look in yourself when you feel, you know, when you find yourself suffering, it is, I'm experiencing this and nobody else is, that makes it sometimes unendurable, less endurable. And so we who know that, if we can offer an expression of recognition, just that immediate recognition and connection with that person or that being who's suffering, that's sometimes all we can do. But it's a lot. It's a lot to do. Is to make that gesture of connection with someone who's suffering. I mean, we see people suffering, it's like, God, we don't want to get too close, like we might catch it. You know, like, God, they're depressed. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to get depressed, or whatever. They're fearful. I don't want to deal with them. I don't want to get fearful. And so we avoid sometimes. But if we can feel. If we can recognize in ourselves our own fear of being compassionate, or our own kind of like self-consciousness, then we can not be identified with that and kind of put it aside and say, even though I feel afraid to, or I feel self-conscious about, you know, I also feel connected to, and then make some gesture of that connection, make some display of that connection. That's all that suffering requires, is that we make that we not cut off from it, and that we make some gesture of recognition. And then you can proliferate that endlessly. You know, you can make a whole career out of responding to suffering. So,
great. Talking about.
Just deluded la-la or feeling of well-being. What's the difference? Or is there?
Can I add something? I always used to think that, you know, getting in touch with my dukkha was the key. You know, if I could really get in touch with dukkha, then I'd have motivation to practice.
Sure.
And almost despite myself, I'm feeling more and more well-being and less dukkha. sometimes I think, well, you know, that's bad.
Yeah, yeah. The happiness of deluded la-la-ism doesn't last. You know, we all have experienced the happiness of deluded la-la land, but only for a brief period of time. That happiness doesn't last. It's due to circumstances or conditions, and those conditions change, and when they do, then we fall out of it. And if we're really deluded, we'll look to try to get it back again. And without naming names, we know people like that. People that will do anything to avoid dealing with reality. You know, and just constantly pursuing pleasure and distraction and just keeping themselves busy so that they don't have to feel and know what's really going on with themselves. But the feeling of well-being isn't dependent on even pleasant experience. Very different. You can be having an unpleasant physical or even an unpleasant emotional experience and still have a feeling of well-being. That's what's so paradoxical. That I saw this feeling of well-being is it's the feeling of well-being in the knowing of what's going on. What's going on may be very unpleasant. But the knowing of it brings the clarity of knowing it brings or comes with a feeling of well-being. It's subtle. Vipassana or insight or wisdom is like that. It steps back from experience and takes in a bigger view. You know? And if you're right in it, you're caught in it. You're caught in the content of your unpleasantness. But if you have a little bit of awareness and you step back and you're aware that you're experiencing something unpleasant, well, that awareness can be quite stable and calm and at ease. And that's the place that insight practice is pointing us to, that the place of knowing in a calm, clear, continuous way whatever's happening. What's happening may be very intense and unpleasant, but the knowing of it and resting in that knowing of it can be very calm and easeful and not a struggle, just happening naturally. That's where freedom, liberation lies, is not being entangled in that which is being known, but resting in the clarity of the knowing. Am I making sense? Are you following that a little bit? Okay.
So where do other traditions point? Zen, Tibetan Buddhism?
Where do other traditions point? So the question is about where do other traditions or other practices point in their practice? Specifically, he was asking about Zen tradition or Tibetan tradition. Never having practiced in the Zen tradition, one sesshin, and never having practiced in the Tibetan tradition, one retreat, I can't speak with any confidence or personal experience, except to say that developing the qualities of the mind that allow you to be able to do that, to have that clarity of observation and understanding, there are a lot of qualities of mind that can be developed. Anything that develops patience, acceptance, letting go, compassion, understanding, generosity, sensitivity, sincerity, integrity, perseverance, anything that develops any of those and others will support that. And so a lot of traditions have different techniques, whether it's reflections or practices, for developing some aspect or some quality of the mind which is necessary or beneficial for that understanding. Without getting any more specific. We're working with a multifaceted mind, or there's many qualities in the mind. I was telling Rich over lunch today about this effect called amplitude. You know, there are five flavors: salt, sour, sweet, bitter, and this other one I can never remember. But anyway, there's five flavors. And whenever you taste something, there's some combination, some mixture of these five flavors. But when these five flavors get mixed in the right amount and they're in balance, they have a magnifying effect on each other, and you get this effect called amplitude. Heinz ketchup has amplitude. Coca-Cola has amplitude. And there's a few other, you know, really notable things. It just, when you taste them, you drink them, you go, okay. The mind is like that. The mind has many qualities. When the wholesome qualities are brought together in balance, they have an amplituding effect. They magnify each other. And that's where you get, you know, you get piercing insight. You get, you know, you get the clarity of understanding. You get the stability of confidence. You get what would you call it? The collectedness of mind. It's where you get this effortless energy when the qualities of mind are really developed and brought together in balance. So any practice that works on any of those qualities of mind is a useful practice. Different traditions have different practices for doing that. What? Do monks cry? Let's see. I have no idea. As a monk, when I was a monk for 5 years, I don't remember if I cried or not. But after I disrobed in, I think, 1990, 91. And it was about 10 years before I went back to see my teacher in Burma, Saido Pandita. And when I went to see him for the first time in 10 years after having disrobed, when I saw him, I started crying. I was really, I was just moved to tears. But it wasn't sadness crying, it was happiness crying. So I think monks could cry. I don't think it's prohibited, and I think that they could be moved to. But they might also have, you know, as they practice, they might develop the balance of mind that would recognize the stimulation of happiness, joy, or sadness, or whatever it is, but not actually get to the point of tears. But you could ask the next monk you see. In fact, you should ask every monk that you see. Do you cry?
Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering, you know, if you ever really get to a state where you don't feel that intensity enough, like if you do see suffering, to see that and to cry, you know, and to feel all those feelings.
Did you kind of hear what she was saying? Yeah, a little bit. Well, she's talking about how when she's very sensitive to, which is just in a very sensitive place, she sees suffering or whatever, and she cries more easily. I think something like that. And one, she was wondering whether one gets so desensitized or so impersonal, or whatever, that they don't. Is that it? They don't cry. I think that what I see happening over the course of practice is that, yes, we do become more sensitive, much more sensitive, and we open to other, I don't want to sound too new agey, other dimensions of the mind. We open to just a lot more of what's going on in the mind. And in that, we may be very moved by the human condition. whether it's the joy of the human condition or the suffering of the human condition or the color of a sunset. We can be very moved by that. Tears may come due to joy. Tears may come due to a recognition that there's just a tremendous amount of suffering in the world that we just can't do anything about. But I think that what those who practice and mature in their practice don't have happen is getting caught in aversive grief to the condition of the world. Okay? Seeing the condition of the world and just falling into a pit of depression or falling into a pit of despair or falling into a pit of just grieving that you just can't... I see that happening less and less in mature practitioners, those who practice and have matured their mind. There's a recognition of these feelings or these conditions, but not a getting stuck in those states of mind. Yeah. I think that's a good question because it points to, do we actually get rid of anything in practice? Or do we just open to the fullness of what is happening, but have a different way of relating to it? And I think that's the direction of practice. We don't get rid of this and get all this. You know, we get rid of all the unpleasant things in our life and we have just kind of like in love and peace and joy and happiness. It's not like that. But we open to the full range. You don't just open to the kind of the high side of life. You open to 360. You know, you open to everything. But you develop the relationship that can open to all of these things, pleasant or unpleasant, positive or negative, wholesome or unwholesome, but not get caught there. That's the difference. You have a relationship of understanding, openness and understanding, rather than kind of resisting it or fearing it or getting caught in grieving it or depressed by it, something like that. Somebody else had a question?
Yeah.
What do I do on a two-day non-residential retreat? Come tomorrow and you'll see for yourself. There will be a series of... Basically, we'll be spending time together, sitting, walking, having some dialogues like this, getting some instruction. This weekend, the instruction will tend to be... will be mostly about mindfulness, but it'll be a lot about mindfulness of mind. Not mindfulness of body. We know how to do mindfulness of body. We've all been paying attention to our breath and our steps for years. Okay, now we're going to pay attention to the mind in the same with the same degree of, you know, instruction and attentiveness. And so a lot of what I've been talking about will be pointing at that and getting some pointers and finding out what's difficult about that and what's easy and hopefully get some encouragement to practice that way. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think the question is about correct understanding or right understanding, and what more can I say about that besides it being impermanent and impersonal? I saw my mind going in two directions. One was to say nothing. There's nothing else I can say about that. And the other was to go into a long discourse about filling out what you just said. I think the understanding of their impermanent and their impersonal comes at the end of a period of practice. In the beginning of practice, I think the right understanding to have is that, you know, either there's observing going on or there's not. Either we are aware or we're not in each moment. That's an important understanding. But and then to understand the relationship between this moment and the next moment. So there's a developing the right understanding of that. To develop the right understanding that conditions arise, each moment presents an experience.
Every moment we are experiencing something. How we relate to that is very different depending on how we understand it. If we think that, you know, this shouldn't be happening, I shouldn't be having these thoughts, I'm trying to meditate, that's wrong understanding. That misunderstanding will cause you a lot of suffering. If you sit and you think, I should be able to sit and not experience pain in my body. If you have that wrong understanding, you'll definitely suffer. Or if you have any wrong understanding, that will cause you suffering. And so if once you see that you're suffering, physically and mentally, you know you have some wrong understanding there. I didn't believe this. I thought, how can having pain in the body be a wrong understanding? Right? Pain in the body, I was like, what's that got to do with understanding? It's true. If you have pain in the body, you're understanding your experience wrongly. Try that one on. It's true. So, right understanding. I think we develop right understanding through having trying to have a right attitude about practice that we're going to open to, we're going to accept, we're going to try to accept, try to be with, and understand what's happening. But in that, the actual doing of opening to pleasant and unpleasant and accepting it, that's a challenge, isn't it? It's a challenge to accept, to really acknowledge this is the way it is. This is the way it's meant to be. And not try to fix it, not try to get rid of it, not try to judge it, not blame somebody for it. Those are all wrong understanding. If you're trying to get something, trying to get rid of something, trying to fix something, trying to blame somebody for it, whatever, wrong understanding. Your experience is your experience. Dumb.
Yeah.
Right. No, I think the question is about pain in the body, and when is the pain in the body sending us a message that we need to listen to, and when is it just being, stupid? As an organism, of course, there'll be unpleasant experiences in the body, As we grow old, as we get sick, as when we die, whatever, stub your toe, there's going to be unpleasantness in the body. How we understand that can make for more or less suffering in the mind. If we understand, this is the nature of the body. This is the nature of the body. And can accept that, then there's much less suffering in the mind. On the other hand, if we think, this is my body, my body's hurting, and that, we got to fix it, what did I do wrong, and how come me, and poor me. There's a tremendous amount of unnecessary suffering there. So how do we understand pain in the body? Of course, if we're doing something that is causing this pain, whether it's sticking your hand in a fire or sitting in a way that's going to wreck your knee, of course we want to respond to that. But we want to understand that this pain in the body or this unpleasantness in the body, that's the nature of the body. If, some people think, and this is true, some people think they should be able to live in such a way as to experience no pain in their body. I don't think that's possible. There's pain in the body. That's the nature of the body. Can we open to it and accept that? Not that we have to make it worse or aggravate it, but we also don't want to live in denial of it. And especially, we don't want to live in fear of discomfort in the body. That's a challenge. We most of us fear discomfort in the body.
Most of us are limited by our fear of discomfort in the body. And anybody who's practiced very long, has tried to sit for 45 minutes, has come up against their fear of discomfort in the body. You may not have recognized it, but if you've shifted your posture within 45 minutes sitting, you have avoided dealing with your fear of discomfort in the body. Why do we shift our posture when we get uncomfortable sitting? Why do we do that? Because we're afraid of feeling pain. We're afraid of feeling uncomfortable. Rather than making a big deal of the pain, take a look at the fear. That's where the real learning takes place, is fear. What do you do in the face of fear? It can be fear of pain in the body, it can be fear of snakes, it can be fear of the dark, it can be fear of anything. Do you see the difference? You can focus on that pain, that painful object. You can focus on the pain in your knee forever and never see the fear of pain. But the fear of pain is where all the suffering is taking place. If you shift, if you turn your attention to the fear of the pain and you deal with the fear, the pain will be transformed. The pain event that you experience in the knee will look very different if you have no fear of it. Very different. I'm not out in the ice field, am I? You following me? It's your relationship to this sensation in the body. If you fear it, it's pain. If you accept it, it's not pain. Okay, we started to go over the time limit. Probably somebody has, the janitor has to close up the building. Is there one last question, or should we say, wrap it up? Okay. So thank you for coming and bringing your energy and sharing your energy. And I hope that some of what was said or what you experienced will find its way into your mind and work in the background to bring about some more right understanding or some inspiration for practice. And may that be a source of less suffering for all of us.